The following program, a presentation of the North Carolina Reading Service, is intended for blind and print-impaired listeners. It's the Independent Indie Week, read weekly, and today it's read by John Federson. This issue is dated May the 17th of 2024. And here we go to get started. And we'll begin in Durham, where the gubernatorial candidate Josh Stein, the current Attorney General of North Carolina, kicks off Teacher Appreciation Week with a stop in Durham. As a storm crept into the skyline overhead, dozens of Durham residents and public officials huddled into dwellies in Brightleaf Square on Monday evening. The crowd waited anxiously for North Carolina gubernatorial candidate Josh Stein, who was in town to celebrate Teacher Appreciation Week and galvanize voters around education, a topic his campaign thinks is a winning issue for the state's Democratic slate in this fall's election. Before Stein took to the podium, a couple of opening acts were on hand to hype up the audience. The first speaker, Mo Green, candidate for NC Superintendent of Public Instruction. Green asked exuberantly, "I'm calling on individuals who are champions of public education to announce who they are. Will you do that for me?" Zwelly's co-owner and Durham mayor, Leo Williams, followed Green. He told the crowd they needed to prepare to get uncomfortable in making the push to reach voters outside of Durham, a statement that Stein would later echo in his speech. Williams left quickly after his remarks. He drew a laugh from the crowd. He said, "I have a council meeting to go to. Pray for me." Stein took the mic next and made the case against the Republicans in the legislature who are set to consider an expansion of a private school voucher program. And Stein said, "They're taking money out of our public school kids' backpacks to put it into the bank accounts of rich people, sending their kids to unaccountable private schools, and it is wrong." While invoking policy is one way of motivating a crowd, appearing to their fears is another. Stein touched on some of the more outlandish statements from his GOP opponent, North Carolina Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson, who, perhaps not coincidentally, struck a conciliatory tone toward public schools at an education event in Raleigh this week. "He calls teaching indoctrination," said Stein. "He called public school teachers demons and wicked people. It's unfathomable that anyone would think these things about public school educators, let alone say them out loud." Attacks on teachers' character and their pay has caused upheaval across the state. Stein said one out of nine teachers have abandoned the profession, a 50% increase from the previous year. He said, "This is a real crisis, one that we must take on full force. Our teachers need fair pay, and as governor, I will fight to raise teacher pay to ensure they are getting a competitive salary, not only compared to other states, but to other professions in the economy." Stein emphasized the need for strong support staff, such as school nurses, bus drivers, and custodial workers, who help create a safe and positive learning environment for students. Quote, "When we do all these things and more, we will begin to deliver on the promise of North Carolina and build a better and brighter future for our young people, one that is rooted in our shared values of freedom and opportunity for every person. Those are the values my folks taught me growing up, and I expect those are values your parents taught you." Stein mentioned his father, Adam Stein, was one of the lawyers who helped unify the segregated black and white teachers' associations in the 90s into what is now the North Carolina Association of Educators, the NCAE. Durham has recently faced its own reckoning with public school workers' salaries. The Durham Association of Educators, DAE, led educators and staff to protest through sick-outs, demonstrations, and DPS administrative buildings earlier this year. In April, the Public School Board of Education passed its 24-25 proposed budget. The board asked for an additional $26 million in local funding from Durham County, the most the board has ever requested. On June 10th, the Durham County Board of Commissioners will hold its next public hearing. The hearing will be on May 28th before they vote on a final budget. That vote will come on June the 10th. All right, from Durham, we'll head over to Orange County and the school board. Despite an unusual series of events leading up to Orange County School's runoff, the board seems poised to continue on a trajectory of finding consensus. What a lovely long headline that is. Incumbent member Bonnie Hauser is the only candidate running in Tuesday's runoff election for the Orange County School Board of Education's 7th seat, kind of. Her opponent, Jennifer Moore, dropped out of the race and resigned from the school board in April after the News and Observer reported she had lied about having a doctoral degree. But Election Day is Tuesday. Early voting totals have been tallied, and Moore dropped out too late for officials to take her name off the ballot. Her name, coupled with Hauser stationed outside Hillsborough's only polling place with an Ms. Moore has withdrawn sign, has caused some confusion regardless. The county reported 1,600 voters cast early ballots. The school board runoff is paired with two Republican second primaries, so it's not clear how many of those actually voted in the school board race. In the fallout from the NNO story, Moore issued a brief statement and retreated from public view. She said she would not take the seat if elected. Still, some of her supporters have continued to campaign, not for Moore as much as against Hauser. Katie Harper wrote in an op-ed in WCHL Chapel Borough, "Sitting out the election would give Hauser the race, so I've decided to fill in the bubble next to Jennifer Moore's name." Harper is the treasurer of Communities Supporting Orange County Schools. That's the political action committee that supported Moore, incumbent board member Carrie Doyle, and newcomer Wendy Padilla in the March election. In an interview with Indy, Harper says she hopes that if Moore is elected, the other six board members, three progressives and three moderates, would come to a consensus on an appointee to serve out that term. The community's PAC recently took out an ad in the News of Orange, a local publication, writing that its members were, quote, blindsided and saddened by dishonesty. But checking the box next to Jennifer Moore's name in the runoff will be a vote for the school board to fill her position with someone who sports the vision of academic excellence and equity we voted for in March. It concluded, though, quote, "For others, the answer is to refrain from voting and accept the runoff challenger, though not selected by a majority of the voters, in March 5, will likely be seated on the school board." That challenger, Hauser, is incredulous at the idea that voters should pick an unknown over her. Moore and Hauser are both Democrats. Hauser tells Indy, "I'm not a bad person. I think we believe in the same thing, so it feels personal." This personalistic approach to politics, especially at the most local levels where everyone seems to know one another and comes together to talk it out in the town square, is part of the American tradition, but it's certainly messy, with grudges spanning decades and interpersonal disputes eclipsing the vast areas of policy agreements between many of those involved. Social media has moved the town square to a digital realm that allows anyone to post their late-night knee-jerk reaction to every single development and then argue about it in the comments. Each side has accused the other of using the tactics of the Trumpian right. But it's not clear how much this election may impact the board's policy decisions because most of the votes this year have been unanimous and uncontroversial. The county, with the encouragement of the board, has indicated it will place a $300 million school bond on the November ballot for some desperately needed capital improvements and all members have been extremely supportive of Danielle Jones, the new superintendent, who has a background in principal oversight and coaching. If Hauser wins the runoff, the board will only have gained one new member, Padilla, from this election cycle, and the board will likely continue on its current track. Topics like race and equity, often mentioned in school board meetings, are headlining the election as well. Moore ran in the March school board election on a slate with Doyle and Padilla, who won first and second place, respectively. Moore came in third, roughly 500 votes ahead of Hauser, who was the top vote-getter for her own slate of three candidates. North Carolina law allowed Hauser to request a runoff because Moore did not receive more than 50% of the vote. Moore is black, Hauser is white. So when Hauser requested a runoff, Moore supporters pointed to the racist politics behind the creation of runoff systems across the South, echoing conversations about Georgia's 2022 U.S. Senate runoff. State Senator Craig Meyer, who represents Orange County, told the News and Observer last week, "The runoff system was likely to stop black folks from being able to single shot and get somebody onto a board even when they didn't have enough votes to get to a majority." Earlier this month, Craig Meyer introduced a bill in the legislature to eliminate the runoff system in Orange County elections. Kay Singer, former school board member, wrote in an editorial, "The election was not too close to call. It was not close enough to ask for a recount. Yet rather than accept her defeat, Bonnie Hauser is using North Carolina GS 163 to call for a runoff election, effectively suppressing those 482 votes." The racial element became more pronounced as the NNO investigated Moore's degree. No one, Moore's supporters argued, was asking the white board members for proof of their degrees. At the beginning of this year, Progressive watched as Harvard pushed out its first black and second female president, Claudine Gay, in a process that seemingly unfairly called her credentials into question. Last year, in Orange County's other school district, Chapel Hill Carrboro City Schools, the NNO also reported on Superintendent Naya Hamlet allegedly wrongly attributing sources in her own doctoral dissertation. Even when the NNO published its story reporting there was no record of Moore receiving a doctoral degree from the school she claimed, some supporters still saw it as a race-based attack. One public school advocacy group that had supported Moore in the March election referred to the NNO story with the hashtag @JimCrow. It's still not at all clear why Moore decided to claim a degree she didn't have. She first requested to be addressed as Dr. Moore in 2021 after her first year on the board and well before any re-election campaign. While Moore didn't hold a position as powerful as the head of one of the nation's foremost universities and wasn't wrongfully persecuted, she's also not exactly a George Santos type of pathological liar who was able to build an entire career around an egregiously large and often contradictory web of lies. After the NNO story broke, Moore released a brief statement in the News of Orange. Quote, "I accept responsibility for not clarifying that I do not have a PhD," it concluded, and did not respond to requests for comment on this particular story. Harper lists several reasons that she and others will not vote for Hauser in the runoff election. One of those is the departure last year of Dr. Monique Felder, the former superintendent, which caused an uproar. Felder, a black woman who steered the district through the COVID pandemic and oversaw an increase in graduation rates for black students and a decrease in racial disparities in school discipline, left before her contract with the district expired. The conversations regarding this departure took place in closed sessions with members legally unable to disclose information. That secrecy has allowed anyone with a keyboard to provide their own speculation on Facebook. Some Hauser supporters say Felder mishandled thousands of dollars. Some Moore supporters say the board majority with Hauser at the helm pushed out Felder because they don't agree with her focus on equity. Which is all bullshit, said Hauser, of all the rumors. Arguing no one except the board and Felder herself knows why she departed before her contract ended. I will just say by fact that it is all a lie. That is bullshit. In her campaign literature, Hauser notes that all seven of the board members voted for the separation agreement. Harper, the treasurer of the community's PAC, says that's misleading. And she wrote, while all board members voted publicly to accept the resignation, it's incorrect to imply that all board members wanted Dr. Felder to leave. Carrie Doyle, Jennifer Moore, and Sarah Smiley were vocal in their support of Dr. Felder's leadership and disappointed by her departure. And at the time, Felder said she wanted to continue her work. Both Harper and Hauser say they hope voters see this election as a referendum on decisions that the current board has made. These include a few areas of disagreement, but many votes that were taken unanimously. One vote that split the board was its 4-3 decision back in 2022 to delay the implementation of the improvement plan for Gravelly Hill Middle School. The board members who voted in the minority, which included Moore, argued that it was an overreach. Not long after the principal of Gravelly Hill, another black woman, stepped down in the middle of the school year. Hauser, who voted in the majority, says she stands by the decision to delay the plan. Some progressives have said the board was too moderate in implementing Senate 49, the so-called Parents' Bill of Rights, even though the board voted unanimously. The new law from the Republican state legislature, among other provisions, bans curricula from including discussion of gender identity or sexuality for students in kindergarten through fourth grade. It also requires schools notify parents if their child changes their pronouns at school. The Chapel Hill Carrboro City School Board decided not to comply with the law, arguing it could put LGBTQ students at risk by forcing schools to out the kids to their parents. That decision has triggered backlash and potential legal trouble. Orange County's current board took a quiet approach, unanimously decided to comply with the law in a way that would make minimal changes to the district's already existing and progressive policies to support LGBTQ and minority students. Hauser said at a forum this spring, if students don't want to change their pronouns or names on their permanent school records, then nothing happens. All the sitting members running for re-election, including Hauser and Moore, reaffirmed their support for the existing policy. Hauser saying, nobody had been able to explain to me why we should break the law because it doesn't do anybody any good. The board also unanimously voted to keep several explicit books in school libraries after backlash from conservatives. Hauser says some people have wrongly linked her to the movement to ban those books. She says, I'm spiritually against book banning. She's influenced by her mother's experience as a Holocaust survivor. She says she voted against the ban because it's not the board's job to regulate books. Part of the criticism against Hauser comes because Cindy Schreiner and Michael Johnson, the candidates who she ran with in March, seemed to be further to her right on some issues that came up at forums. Neither Schreiner nor Johnson were registered with either major party, and at the time, the Orange County Republican Party recommended via tweet that voters pick Schreiner and Johnson, but didn't mention Hauser. Last month, the GOP recommended Hauser for the runoff. Friends of Orange County Schools, a PAC founded in 2022, has also backed Hauser's original slate. The Friends PAC is backed by Susan and Stephen Halkiotis, an education power couple who both have decades of experience working in and managing Orange County schools. Stephen Halkiotis, who previously chaired the board, is still the target of community criticism for his response to the 2016 movement to ban the Confederate flag from schools. He was called out for slow-walking the movement, but argued that a good decision would take time. He ultimately was part of the unanimous vote to ban it. To Meyer, the district's progressive state senator, the Halkiotis' support for Hauser was enough of a reason not to vote for her. Meyer says he worked on a committee that presented a report on racial achievement gaps to the board back in 2007, when George W. Bush was president and Orange County's current high school seniors were just learning to walk. In his endorsements this year, Meyer wrote, quote, "Steve Halkiotis staged a coup and became board chair at his very first meeting. After receiving our report, he thanked us and moved on. Progress on equity work stalled." Hauser says she is, quote, "good friends with the Halkiotis, but she is an independent thinker. I'm not their puppet," Hauser says. "They'll be the first to tell you that Bonnie is nobody's puppet." All right, next in my pile of articles brings us over to Raleigh City Council, who has approved spending $5 million on a new pilot program that includes a component to provide direct rent assistance to unsheltered individuals. The council approved funding for the Unsheltered Homelessness Response Program on Tuesday during its regular business meeting. Now, that's a week ago Tuesday. Approximately $1.9 million is earmarked for direct subsidies to unsheltered individuals living in camps and $1.1 million for administrative cost and staffing. As many as 40 households will receive monthly subsidies to help people experiencing homelessness move into permanent housing. Emily Sutton, director of Raleigh's Housing and Neighborhoods Department, told the council, "At its roots, homelessness is a housing problem, and this might sound obvious, but in practice, many of the strategies to address homelessness are overly focused on social services rather than the thing that actually ends homelessness, which is housing." Another $2 million will go to expand housing options for individuals exiting homelessness. Most of the money, $1.6 million, will be used to repair city-owned rental units at Studios at 2800. That's a hotel converted to housing for people experiencing homelessness. The remainder will be used to make repairs to other affordable housing options. City staffers will ask the council for additional funds for homelessness prevention and diversion initiatives and support for nonprofits during the city's annual budget process. The city also pledged to work with local agencies and stakeholders to develop a community-wide unsheltered homelessness response strategy. The pilot program comes less than a month after Raleigh police were asked to clear a tent encampment of more than 40 people off U.S. 70 near Garner. Critics argued that forcing unhoused people to leave the encampment was tantamount to criminalizing homelessness. Patrick O'Neill, a Garner resident who organized a press conference last month to protest this removal, said, "While I think this new program has merit, getting people into affordable housing is the only real answer to our collective shame. The elimination of poverty is attainable in this country. We must have the will to do it." According to a City of Raleigh press release, more than 6,000 individuals seek homelessness support services. More than 6,000. The 2023 Wake County point-in-time count found 900 individuals experience homelessness in Wake County on any given night. That's a 200% increase since the year 2020. Sutton said, "Clearing camps is not a solution. It just displaces people, harms their trust in local government, and spends money on something that does not solve the problem. Sutton went on, saying taxpayers spend $35,000 a year on one person experiencing homelessness, which outweighs the estimated $32,000 subsidy to build one affordable housing unit, or the $18,000 to $20,000 a year to provide rent assistance. And Sutton said the best solution to reducing the public cost of homelessness is to move people into housing. Next, back to Durham, an article just released by Lena Geller, one of the IndyWeek's main authors. This is a long article about derelict properties in East Durham, and I'm going to attempt to read all of it. It begins, the foundations are crumbling, the floors are sinking, there's no air conditioning, there's no heat, the windows don't shut, the pipes are broken, rats, mice, and cockroaches are nesting in open cavities in walls and ceilings. People living in four East Durham properties that Leonzo and Loretta Lynch inherited from the Reverend Lorenzo Lynch Sr. in 2023 say their homes have been in disrepair for years. That's why, when the tenants were sued last summer by Leonzo for staying past the terms of month-to-month leases they had signed with his deceased father, they filed counterclaims, asking the court for damages. A Durham County magistrate ruled last fall the tenants deserve compensation. Magistrate Judge Marlon Howard awarded $2,500 in damages to one tenant and $10,000, the maximum that can be awarded in small claims court, to four others back in November 29th. But the tenants haven't received any money yet. Deborah Nash, who was awarded $2,500, appealed her judgment to district court. The amount was too low for her, she says. And Leonzo, as executor of his father's estate, appealed the higher judgments. Now, Legal Aid of North Carolina, the nonprofit firm representing the tenants, pro bono, is gearing up for a fight against the Cary-based law firm that Leonzo retained after the small claims trial didn't go his way. The trials are scheduled to start in mid-July. Most of the tenants haven't paid rent on the homes in more than a year, and Leonzo is not asking for back pay. As part of the suit, he's just asking them to leave. But tenants say they cannot afford to relocate, so they're still living, squatting, technically, in the four houses. Tenants each have certain areas of their homes they're careful to avoid. For Deborah Nash, it's her kitchen, where cords jerry-rigged from an uncovered breaker box hang like vines over her countertop, or her cooktop. For Kathy Panzarella, it's her living room, where 3 years ago, her roof caved in on top of her while she was asleep, she says, breaking her arm. Panzarella, 61, and her husband Tommy live off their Social Security checks. So does Nash, 66. Joseph Davis, 63, worked for Durham's street cleaning division for three decades and is raising two teenage sons on a modest pension. Kimberly Smith, 34, who has three kids, relies on unemployment. It's hard to get a job without transit, she says. Pamela Page, 42, is a single mom of two and gets by on a patchwork of income from child advocacy work. The tenants started renting the homes between 4 and 6 years ago. Until the Lynch family patriarch died in 23, tenants paid him between $500 and $1,200 a month in rent, according to court records. Over the course of their tenancies, they paid between $16,000 to $40,000 in rent on homes they allege were in disrepair the entire time. The tenants say they also paid for rodent traps, paint, space heaters, and window air conditioning units to make the homes livable. Some hired their own contractors to repair gutters, windows, and plumbing fixtures. Two tenants say they have run themselves dry, paying astronomical water bills caused by leaky pipes. the counterclaims tenants filed in response to Lorenzo's initial suits specify they are requesting, quote, monetary damages in the form of retroactive rent abatement for each month of their tenancies in amounts equal to the difference between the fair rental value of the premises had they been in fit habitable condition and the value they actually received. They're also asking for incidental and consequential damages resulting from their landlord's acts or failures to act, according to court records. At the upcoming trial, tenants could potentially be awarded even more than $10,000 each because district court doesn't have the cap that small claims does, or they could leave empty-handed. Eviction cases aren't rare in Durham. The eviction docket at Durham County Courthouse typically has between 150 to 200 cases per week, but these five cases are perhaps a bit more charged because of who the plaintiff's family is. Lorenzo Sr. pastored one of Durham's most prominent black churches for decades. Leonzo pastors a large church in Charlotte, and Loretta served as Attorney General of the United States under President Barack Obama. When Lorenzo Sr. died, age 90, last January, he left everything to Leonzo and Loretta, including 18 properties in North Carolina, worth an assessed value of over $1 million. According to property records, Lorenzo Sr. acquired those over the course of three decades, beginning in 1970. Loretta's role in determining the fate of the East Durham properties where tenants have lived is unclear. In a case report regarding one of the properties, code enforcement officer Lauren Milton wrote in an entry last January, he, quote, spoke with the son, Leon, who stated he and sister will be settling the estate in the coming weeks and making decisions as to properties owned. 2 months later, Milton wrote in a subsequent entry, Leonzo, quote, plans to meet with his sister and a potential property manager to determine next steps for each property. But Loretta does not appear to be in direct communication with the city about the properties and is not named in the lawsuits. Neither she nor representatives from Brownlee, Whitlow, and Prate, the law firm he retained, responded to multiple emailed requests for comment. Loretta Lynch did not respond to requests for comment that the Indy delivered via voicemail, email, and fax. Lorenzo Lynch Sr. also collected the rent from his tenants in person, even at age 90. He'd sometimes chat with them about his long-term vision for his properties. Page says Lorenzo Sr. told her he wanted his kids, quote, to refurbish these homes and make sure they were for low-income families. Him buying all these homes was about building the Lynch legacy, says Page. Most tenants weren't aware of how large the Lynch legacy already loomed. Lorenzo Sr., a fourth-generation Baptist minister from eastern North Carolina, came to regional renown during his first few decades in the ministry. In the summer of 1960, he invited college students who were organizing the Greensboro sit-ins to use the church that he pastored at the time, Providence Baptist, as a planning space. That's from his obituary, and continued to model an approach to faith that straddled civic engagement and civil rights over the course of his career. In Durham, where he moved in 1965, Lorenzo Sr. was the best known for pastoring White Rock Baptist Church. That church had evolved in tandem with Durham's historic Haiti, and faced the same existential threat the community did when Durham Freeway was constructed in the late 60s. Lorenzo Sr. led the process of securing White Rock, a new building on Fayetteville Street, where it still stands today. He was also a fixture in local civic circles, serving as the Economical Development Chair for the Durham Committee on the Affairs of Black People, and mounted an unsuccessful bid for mayor in 1973. Lorenzo Sr. and his wife, Laureen, a librarian who died in 2019, raised their kids in Durham. The eldest son, Lorenzo Jr., who died in 2009, was a Navy SEAL. Leonzo, the youngest, followed his father's footsteps into the ministry. After attending UNC Greensboro and earning a master's degree in divinity from Duke and a doctorate from the United Theological Seminary, Leonzo went on to pastor at churches around the state. He joined Charlotte's Ebenezer Baptist in 1997 and is now the senior pastor there. After graduating as a valedictorian from Durham High School, now Durham School of the Arts, in 1977, Loretta attended college and law school at Harvard and worked as a federal prosecutor before she became the first black woman appointed U.S. Attorney General in 2015. Now she's a partner at a multinational law firm based in New York City. Earlier this month, she returned to Durham to deliver the commencement speech at the North Carolina Central University School of Law. Tenants say they know Lorenzo Sr. had a notable presence in Durham and that his kids were off doing big things. Lorenzo Sr. had a striking gift for connecting with people, say his tenants. And Paige says he was a good man, very knowledgeable, never disrespectful. He was always sharing home remedies and bits of wisdom. Panzarella says, when my son died, he bought me sodas. But the Lynch family's prominence never figured into their day-to-day reality, tenants say, which was that their landlord was old and in failing health and that no one seemed to be coming to pick up the slack. Tenants say they thought Lorenzo Sr.'s memory was starting to slip in the later years. They also say when they told him they needed repairs, he sometimes hired people to come by who weren't professionals and often left their homes in the same condition, if not worse. Tile was placed in Davis's kitchen that now cracks and shifts underfoot, according to court records. During Lorenzo Sr.'s memorial service in 2023, which was live streamed on YouTube, Loretta noted her father, quote, would pick up men from the homeless shelter to have work on his real estate, saying he spoke to them with the same respect he did President Obama. He truly did walk with kings, but never lost the common touch, she said. Two tenants tried going to the city for help. In November 2020, Smith called in a complaint to Durham Neighborhood Improvement Services, that's NIS, about the duplex she lives in on Potter Street. Panzarella, who lives in the other half, phoned Durham One Call 7 months later to complain, quote, her roof fell in, and, quote, she has made complaints and concerns to her landlord many times, and he has yet to address this issue. Both sides of the duplex failed NIS inspections, so the department sent notices to Lorenzo Sr. ordering him to correct specific code violations, according to NIS reports. Lorenzo Sr. did not comply, reports show. The NIS conducted more inspections and sent more notices over the next 2 years, and he ignored those too. Finally, in November 9th of 2022, Lorenzo Sr. contacted the city to say he would soon be making repairs to that duplex, according to a report from NIS. 2 months later, he died. Panzarella and Smith say that aside from a paint touch-out, the repairs never happened. No one told the tenants Lorenzo Sr. was dead. When he didn't show up to collect the February rent, they put two and two together and waited for his heirs to contact them. In April 2023, a letter from his son arrived at a three-bedroom house where Paige lives. It was addressed to tenant and stated that starting in May, the house would be managed by HCO, a Chapel Hill-based property management company. That seemed like a good sign. An HCO representative came by a few weeks later and showed Paige how to start paying rent through a portal on the company's website. HCO did not respond to multiple requests from here for comment. But Nash, Panzarella, and Smith say no one contacted them until June, when they were served summary ejectment complaints. That's the equivalent of eviction notices in North Carolina. And court summonses were attached. Leon Zoez, an executor of his father's estate, was demanding, quote, immediate possession of their homes. They were being sued for over the terms of their leases. Or someone was being sued. The complaints and summonses Nash, Panzarella, and Smith received were addressed to unknown occupant slash tenant, according to records the Indy reviewed. The next month, Davis got the same materials, addressed to John Smith. Page did too. Nash, Panzarella, and Smith went to Durham County Courthouse for initial hearings. On June 23rd, Panzarella had heard of legal aid and tracked down one of the nonprofit's attorneys, Robbie Breitweiser, at the courthouse clinic. Breitweiser agreed to represent Panzarella and her neighbors. Page and Davis went to the courthouse for initial hearings in late July. Davis, whose friends with the Potter Street tenants had been advised to seek out Breitweiser. Page says she went in with no plan, but encountered a reporter who asked if she needed help. After hearing about the case, advised she go to the legal aid clinic. Tenants, say Breitweiser, spent the next several months trying to negotiate settlements with the Anzel's attorneys, but the most they were offered was $2,500, and the tenants passed. When Magistrate Judge Howard awarded four of them, four times that much last November, they were glad to have rejected the initial offering. And Nash, who isn't sure why she was awarded $2,500 while the others won $10,000, felt hopeful that a higher court would bring her up to par. Lorenzo's appeals caught them off guard. The Lynch family has the money, say the tenants. They point to the stature of the plaintiff's sister, as well as the law firm that Leonzo brought on for the appeals, as a case in point. The attorneys there at Brownlee, Whitlow, and Pratt charge between $260 and $500 an hour for their services, according to a client intake specialist. Panzarella says she knows Loretta isn't officially involved in the legal dispute, but feels as though she is a relevant player because she also inherited the properties, saying, why didn't she and her brothers help Mr. Lynch fix our houses? Why didn't they even know our names? What are they going to do with the money they get from selling these properties? I want to know what kind of trips they're going to take with that money. Tenants aren't sure what to expect for the upcoming trial. It shouldn't pose a problem for them that Leonzo himself is not the one who leased them the homes. Breitweiser wrote in a statement to the Indy, a landlord's death does not extinguish the legal rights of his or her tenants, nor does it generally preclude liability for acts or omissions that occurred when the landlord was alive. The rules of professional conduct require attorneys to advocate zealously on behalf of their clients, regardless of who the opposing party is. Still, North Carolina law does not do much to defend tenants' rights. 2 months ago, the state Supreme Court ruled 5-2 that a tenant who was maimed by a gas explosion in a Durham rental home could not sue his landlord for negligence because there wasn't evidence that the tenant had previously communicated a need for repairs. That rule could bode poorly for Nash, Davis, and Page. Unlike Smith and Panzarella, whose complaints to the city in 2020 and 21 resulted in prompt inspections and issuances of orders for repair, the other three tenants did not make complaints while Lorenzo Sr. was alive. The NIS didn't inspect their homes till last summer after the dispute began. While those inspections found dozens of code violations that clearly stem from years of neglect, the duration of the disrepair may end up mattering less in court than the evidence, or lack thereof, that Lorenzo Sr. was made aware of it. Regardless of how the trial concludes, though, the fact that all four of the homes are standing, occupied, and up to date on inspection is coming with its own costs for the plaintiff and his sister. For example, the city of Durham condemned the duplex where Nash lives on Potter Street in October. But because the residence is still standing and in use, the city did maintenance work on it 2 months ago and placed a $556 lien on the property that the Lorenzo Sr.'s heirs will have to pay off. The city is also preparing to restore heating facilities in the house where Paige lives on Bryant Street, according to a December ordinance that states that Leonzo and Loretta, quote, failed or refused to comply with a previous order to render the home fit for human habitation. The first quote for the installation came in at $16,000. That's a contract services manager that the Indy bumped into while visiting Paige in April. That's also money the city will front as a lien and the owners will need to pay back. Damon says we're looking at all new ductwork, all new heat pump systems, state of the art. Damon admitted it's a bit surprising to do $16,000 of work on a house built in 1940 that has substandard heating equipment, one of 20 violations in an open court enforcement case, and is likely to be torn down. And says, quote, the code states the property needs to be able to maintain a heat to 68 degrees measured within the middle of the room. Currently, the structure can't meet that standard, so we have to move forward with our process. Panzarella is sitting on her front porch on Potter Street. Next door, Nash is too. Smith is away, but her 19-year-old daughter just popped over to Nash's duplex to brave the precarious cooktop and make everyone some food. We don't like living here, Panzarella says. She points at her front door, which is covered in mildew. But we do like living here, she says, nodding at her neighbors. Panzarella, Nash, and Smith all spent chunks of their childhood living on Potter Street. Smith is Nash's niece. Panzarella and Nash call each other sisters, even though they're not actually related. The street is short, just one block, and it ends in a dirt cul-de-sac. Up the hill and through some trees, cars are whooshing by on the Durham Freeway. Panzarella says, I watch them dig out the highway. We'd cross over the big pile of dirt to go trick-or-treating in the other neighborhoods. In a geographic sense, all the tenants like where they live. Resources for their children are within walking distance. The streets are quiet and relatively safe. Multiple tenants say no one bothers you here. After the trial, they're hoping to relocate nearby, but even if they're each awarded damages, they're not sure it will be feasible. The pickings are slim, literally. Those skinny new builds with for sale signs in the front yard with QR codes lead to websites that say things like modern and sleek. A minimalist's dream come true are everywhere. Two of them on Bryant Street sold last year for a little under $350,000 each. Both houses are smaller than 1,300 square feet. It's still a good community, Paige says, but they strong-armed some folks out of here, didn't they, T? T is Paige's neighbor, a lifelong resident of Bryant who happens to be strolling by at this moment. She squints and nods and keeps walking. Paige looks at the skinny houses down the street. She's been wondering about other properties Lorenzo Sr. owned in the area. Quote, there's a lot I didn't know before this. Who knew that your landlord was supposed to provide heat? I didn't know that was part of a landlord-tenant relationship. I'm a fighter, she says. We're going to do this in a cordial way, and we're going to move forward. But what about the people who aren't fighters? What about the people who are scared to say no? The Indy visited all 14 properties that Lorenzo Sr. left to his children in the Triangle. One property is in Southeast Raleigh, a one-story brick house that looks reasonably well-maintained, but that the city of Raleigh in 1997 deemed unfit for human habitation. When the Indy stopped by in April, three men at the door said they didn't know the Lynch family, and it's none of the Indy's business who they pay their rent to. One is in downtown Hillsborough, a falling-apart house in an affluent neighborhood that the town of Hillsborough similarly declared unfit for human habitation in 2017. A neighbor told Indy the house hasn't been occupied in at least a decade. The other 12 are in Durham. Of these, 4 are where Nash, Panzarella, Davis, Smith, and Page currently live. 1 is an undeveloped parcel on Justice Street in North Durham, and the final 7 are clustered on 2 streets in East Durham, Atlantic and Colfax. On Atlantic Street, Lorenzo Sr. left his children 3 houses and a vacant parcel. On Colfax, he left them 2 houses and a vacant parcel. All the properties except one have histories of code violations, ordinances for repair, and liens. According to court records, around the same time that Nash, Panzarella, Davis, and Smith and Page got sued last summer, tenants on Atlantic and Colfax did too. 2 summary ejectment complaints were issued to unnamed occupants on 2 addresses on Atlantic, and a 3rd was issued to a named tenant, Alvaro Hernandez, at Colfax Street. Upon visiting the properties in April of this year, the Indy found empty lots. On Atlantic Street, grass has started to fill in the rectangular dirt plots where the houses stood. Toward the back of the site, there's a pile of wood fragments with personal belongings mixed in, including a floral pillowcase, 2 striped shirts, a broken lampshade, and a Charlie Mingus poster that's still attached to a piece of a wall. A neighbor on his way to work told the Indy the houses were torn down about 6 months ago but were occupied as of a few years ago. On Colfax, there's a similar scene, dirt plot, grass, furniture, and children's toys. When the Indy knocked on the door of a skinny new build around the block, a woman answered and asked, "Are you staying in an Airbnb, too?" The Colfax resident had more information. Through a crack in her screen door, she said that the house at 1210 had been demolished 2 or 3 months ago. She said a Hispanic family had lived there before, but she didn't know them. One day, she says, they were just gone. I have a few minutes left, a couple of minutes. I'll start with this article by Trey Roberts, who works as a manager of community engagement over in Raleigh at Dix Park Conservancy. And he's created the Dix Park Intertribal Powwow, which brings a Native American community together to celebrate its history on parkland as well as its living culture. And he writes this: "How a powwow in Raleigh honors my roots in Hollister, North Carolina. My hometown of Hollister will again be on my mind when the annual Dix Park Intertribal Powwow rolls out May 18th to 19th. Coming right up. As one of the organizers, I work closely with Native American communities and others to make this event happen. And through all the hubbub, it always brings me back to my proud roots and what I learned there. Hollister is a small rural town in Halifax County on the edge of Warren County. When I lived there, we didn't have stoplights. We had caution lights that blinked to warn you you should probably look both ways at the intersection. Major news events of my day included a transformer blowing and setting fire to most of the wooded area. The opening of Dollar General also caused a stir. In Hollister, your house could be tucked away atop a hill in the woods, on a farm, or cozily next door to your relatives on land you inherited from your granddaddy. While it was country in terms of what city folks would call country and had a roughness to it you really don't understand until you're older, the poverty levels placed us in the category of one of the poorest counties in North Carolina. But growing up, it didn't feel like it. Maybe it's because I never felt the brunt of poverty as my family tried their best to hide it from me. Truthfully, Hollister, while small enough to be plagued with town gossip and infighting because someone didn't simply like someone else, was our home. It was the home of my tribe, the Halawa Saponi tribe. As a tribe, we watched out for each other, even though we might side-eye someone's new girlfriend, refuse to eat their collards, or not trust them. Hide your jewelry and don't leave money behind because you know he'll steal. Even with those prejudices, our doors were open and our tables had an extra chair for our uncle, who was alone in his house during a snow day. We were a community and a tribe. Every year, On the third weekend of April, we gathered at the powwow grounds. If we were lucky, which most of the time we were, we'd get the perfect weather, a cool 70-degree sunny day. The smell of sage and sweetgrass mixed in with the naturally growing honeysuckles that grew off the sides of the woods filled the air. It was a homecoming because you got to see cousins your age that lived in other cities up north, and the aunt who rarely left the comfort of her own home. It was a moment to come out in your best outfits, your hair done up, a fresh cut, and new shoes that would end up dusty from the lack of grass. We were to be seen, and our culture was to be celebrated. Looking back at these things, now older, I do so with fondness. At the time, being younger, I also sought a place beyond the pine trees that enveloped Hollister. My desire for more made me resent it as a youth, not knowing that the moment I left the comfort of my tribe would be unmatched in Raleigh. Raleigh has offered me many opportunities, and while being a city, still in adolescence, has given me a sense of community that's rare to find in cities across the country. While it embraced and welcomed me, I also felt this sense of being an outlier. The connections I made are deep and true, but can't be interpreted the same way as the ones I got when I see or meet another Native American, or the time I spent growing up in Hollister. There's an alignment that's close, but just not quite there. I had to figure out a lot of stuff out myself and open myself up to people who didn't quite understand my upbringing or why I spoke or did something a certain way. I was also surrounded by my culture and people who were excited about any progress I made in my life. In Hollister, we had winter powwows, the annual powwows, culture classes, monthly lessons on Native American history, and excitement about new regalia. A sense of community that went beyond the transactional, that was about laying all our cards on the table, never hiding a hand. Outside of the yearly Native American Heritage Celebration, hosted by the Museum of History, there was no other opportunity for us to be celebrated. And that seems like it's about the limit of my time that I'm permitted to go for Indie Week this week. John Feddersen will be departing in just 50 seconds with a reminder that this program is available along with many other podcasts at the ncreadingservice.org website. This will be first broadcast tomorrow, Friday, the 17th, and will be then stashed in this enormous warehouse like Indiana Jones has those things at the end. So, John Feddersen will bid you farewell. Hope that you will join us next week for another edition of Indie Week, the Independent. So long.